The House Committee on Education will come to order. Welcome. If you, like me, have a cell phone, please take it off and turn it all the way to off, not just to vibrate, but all the way to off. What happens is that it disrupts the sound system and makes it difficult for people who are listening on the internet. We have, starting today and for the next 4 days after this one, we have very full agendas that are primarily work sessions and not public hearings so that we can meet our chamber deadline. We also, on some of these, will have to end up carrying them over if we do not yet have our fiscal and revenue statements. And I'm going to go through, I'm going to shift up the order of the agenda so we can do the least time-consuming things first, working up to the things that are going to take more discussion. So I am going to open a work session on House Bill 3050.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, you'll recall that this is one of the license plate bills that is for purposes of referring directly to the Transportation Committee, establishes a $35 surcharge with respect to the education registration plates, is what they're called, declares an emergency, is effective on July 1st, 2009. There is no, because this is going to another policy committee, there is no revenue or fiscal requirement to move this on to transportation. So that is the issue before you.
Thank you. And colleagues, I'll remind you, Representative Berger came and testified on this bill, as well as an intern that is working in her office that has taken this on as a project. We've moved some other bills on to other committees without recommendation, including another license plate bill, but in those cases we hadn't actually had a public hearing. So I would entertain a motion to move this bill to transportation with recommendation if that meets with the approval of the committee.
Madam Chair,
yes,
I move House Bill 3050 be referred to the House Transportation Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Maurer moves House Bill 3050 to the Committee on Transportation with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3050.
Thanks.
I'm going to mess you up by going out of order. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2944. Colleagues, House Bill 2944 is the bill that we heard on Wednesday, that we heard very compelling testimony from the families, and I would very much like to send this forward to the Senate for further discussion about how to improve parent participation and the way that parents, families, and kids are treated in Oregon special education programs. Unfortunately, today we do not have the fiscal statement, we have the revenue, so we're going to carry that bill over to Monday. So with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2944, carrying that over to Monday. And now I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3024. House Bill 3024 would basically merge Portland State University and Oregon Health Sciences University together. If you've had any opportunity to talk with Representative Greenlick, this is a priority of his. President Vivel, who's the president of Portland State University, has some thoughts on this issue that he would like to share with us. He could not be here today, but he can be here next Wednesday. So I'm holding the public hearing on House Bill 3024, public hearing only, over to next Wednesday, the 22nd. So, and if there are people that came today to testify on House Bill 3024, is there anyone that's here to testify on 3024 today that cannot come back next Wednesday? No? Oh, good. I see no. All right. With that, then we're going to close the public...
Madam Chair?
Representative Hoffman.
I'm just curious, because I'm trying to catch up on the rules and stuff. Can we have a first public hearing after today?
We are carrying over the first public
hearing.
We've
got it open.
We're just holding over this public hearing.
Thank you.
Welcome. Any further questions on that?
Christmas.
Seeing none, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3024 and opening a work session on House Bill 2558.
That's my opinion.
Colleagues, this bill was the one we heard from many folks from the town of Toledo, Toledo High School folks. Many of you may have, has anybody received emails from the Applegate school, maybe?
Madam Chair, and that's Representative Richardson's district, although they've come to me as the point person for this. So I'm supportive of this bill.
It's a bill that would move from here to revenue. And before we discuss the merits of the bill, I would entertain a motion with recommendation to move it on to the Revenue Committee.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2558 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue.
So Representative Dimbro moves that House Bill 2558 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation, that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue. And as we move into the discussion, this was a conversation. Typically, the way that the process works with state school fund issues and the adjustment of the state school fund, it runs through the Revenue Committee. So the Revenue Chair flagged this issue and requested that he have it.
Chair Council, just so you're aware, and the committee, there is a letter that's been signed by the Speaker rescinding the subsequent to Ways and Means.
Is there further discussion?
On the motion?
On the motion. There's lots of things in the motion.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Yes.
I don't know how I'll vote on this yet. I'd like to hear other people's input. I have had a concern about the funding formula for quite some time and have requested that we do possibly a work group on the funding formula in the interim with members from this committee and the Revenue Committee working together along with possibly Ways and Means. Every time we tweak this, there's some people that are going to benefit from this and there's people that are going to lose from this. And there is quite an imbalance of resources that go to districts now, and I don't have any problem with saying these districts are deserving and have equal needs to people of comparable size and remoteness, but it's a bigger issue that needs to be addressed with equity amongst the funding formula.
Thank you, Representative Prompt. Is there further discussion? Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Building on what Representative Compass said, I have uncertainties about this. I go back and forth about it. I recognize the need to support those communities. It drives me crazy that they're in the situation they're in. However, like Representative Compass said, it's going to be a redistribution of funds. My district will lose money. It won't be all that much money. But my district will lose money. Now, people in my district would happily contribute more. They would happily pay more taxes for education in this state. If I wish that we were raising more revenues for education all over the state and that these schools were getting more of that money. So I'd be interested in also hearing a little bit more discussion.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I will echo Representative Compass. Although I support the bill, I think it does. It is a larger question in that the inequity on a per student basis across the state ranges from around $7,100 for operational revenue up to $95,000 for a district that has no students. So, or a district that has a couple students and $90,000 per student. So the point is there's a substantial inequity in our distribution of money, and I thought that originally the intent of bringing the funds to the state level was, in fact, equity in distribution of resources. So, but we have done it to ourselves incrementally.
Thank you, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I absolutely agree that the issue is about equity, but I don't equate equity with equality. Giving each school district exactly the same amount of money to do the job with is not equity, because when you're in some of these really remote schools, mm-hmm. if you don't have more, you can't provide an equitable education. And to me, that means, can a person who sits in this classroom and goes through this school district's coursework qualify to go to a state institution of higher learning and get a college degree and go on. I don't expect them to have all the AP courses, but I expect them to be able to do that. And you cannot do that with the same dollars in each of the districts. So for me, if we're going to have any kind of conversation, we really have to have the equity conversation. And the equity conversation is, what do we as Oregonians want all Oregon students to have at least minimally as an education standard? And then what does that cost in these different districts? And then figure out a formula that helps them get there, because there are major differences. And for me, equity is a much bigger question than spending the same amount of money in each kid. When I know, and that's why we have this formula, because the reality is, when I have a student who comes from an environment in which there was not a single piece of reading material, and they come to kindergarten, for the first time they're asked to look at a book, they don't even know how to hold the book. Another group of kids come from families where the books have been a part of their life from before they were born, because the parents read to them when they were pregnant. That person has a much different opportunity when they get there, and our job is to help all of those children that are Oregon's future have the opportunity at the end of that 12 years to make choices in their lives which every other child would have been able to make. And so the disparity between dollars is so great from one to the other, it drives me crazy. But if in the end of the day each of those children is given the opportunity to make the next choice in their life, then we have done an equitable job. And so I look forward to the opportunity to have this conversation. If we had, this bill would not have been necessary if, to put the deal about nearest school in the district, if we didn't have district lines that required them to stay in their district to go to school, and they have this little school district. If they could get to the other district, they probably may have chosen that. It's not an option right now. So for me, I am in favor of this bill.
Thank you. Representative Huffman.
Ditto. Just for the record, Representative Comp and I have talked extensively, and I'm very supportive of, we've got to have a work group to address the formula. It's got to be done. I'm supportive of this. I'm concerned because I have that kind of skirt tail related bill on remote and necessary schools that as of 1 o'clock was still not scheduled to be worked out of revenue. Representative Buckley had wanted to at least get it on the record in Ways and Means as to what the need was to help support the need for the work group. You know, hopefully some of these bills will make it up before Ways and Means to at least be heard and stress the need.
And Representative Huffman, the bill that's sitting in revenue, the revenue committee is sitting easy for the next couple of weeks, since their bills don't die at the end of the day if they're not posted for a work session. So that revenue and rules stay alive.
Thank you for that clarification. So, I even more support pushing this on them. Yes and a half.
Thank you. Is there further discussion?
No.
And Representative Comp, I think you're fine.
Yeah, I'm fine.
And I think the idea of working in the interim, bringing the education committees, probably House and Senate education and revenue committees together and Ed Subs. Mm-hmm. To really talk about how we put this together in a thoughtful way that works for everyone.
Well,
it's important.
May I make another comment, Chair?
Yes.
The other side of that is, what we have might be the best we can do.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And we just haven't analyzed it for a while, and I don't know that, but it's like, okay, because the disparity, or the range of allocations is so broad. It tends to make one person wonder, well, is this the best we can do?
I think it's definitely time for us to have that conversation again. Thank you. Debbie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Hafner?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye and a half.
Representative Comp?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Roeland?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dimbrough?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
And Chair Gilzer?
Aye. Having received the required majority and not a half more, the motion is passed and the bill scurries along to the Revenue Committee. Thank you. Yes.
Just a comment. When they read that, if they would do it in a little different cadence, the name of the people, you'd get aye, which is a good pirate term, and I would really appreciate that. I come from a pirate school.
Oh, it's Friday afternoon.
Yeah.
It's Friday.
I just had to add a little bit of levity to the situation.
That is one of the things I love about this place. Sometimes you just never know what's going to happen next. Very exciting. Okay, so where are we? Where are we now?
That's pretty much enough for me.
So we've done this one, we've done this one, we've done this one and this one. Oh, and we're closing the work session on House Bill 2558. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2507. And since it's actually my bill, I'm giving the gavel away.
Okay. So, Kevin.
Can I go down
to introduce it? Would you go down and testify?
I will go down.
Your bill. That'd be great.
Thanks. I think I brought my bill with me.
Kevin, would you briefly explain 2507, please?
Very briefly, members of the committee, before you is 2507. As I understand, there are going to be perhaps substantial revisions to the bill as it stands right now. It requires that a school district or public charter school award a modified diploma, an extended diploma, or an alternative certificate to students. It also sets the criteria for awarding those modified diploma, alternative diploma, or an alternative certificate. It does declare an emergency and is effective July 1st, 2009.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Sarah Gelser from Corvallis and Philomath, and I am seeking your guidance on House Bill 2507. There are a couple of things that we could do with this, and at your pleasure, I will submit amendments to accomplish them. First, where the bill itself came from. Last session, those of you that were on the House Education Committee were kind enough to pass the Modified Diploma Bill, which was a bill that I sponsored. Unfortunately, in the rulemaking process, despite my participation in every step of the way, the rules were adopted in a way that excluded the students that I was trying to help in the passage of the bill. And so I reintroduced House Bill 2507 to implement that modified diploma in the way that would be consistent with what the legislative intent had been, but rather than leaving it to a rulemaking process this time, it just spelled out very clearly in the law what it was we were trying to accomplish. Because the rulemaking process then created a completely different modified diploma than what the legislature had envisioned and voted upon, I called it something else in this so we don't take away from this new thing that was created for a different population of students. So in this bill, it becomes called an extended diploma. What the goal of this bill was when you have students who have learning challenges that are very, very severe, what we don't want to do is take away their opportunity to learn in academic environments. We want them in middle school and in high school to continue to have exposure to things like social studies and English, and we want to encourage them to pursue something. And what had happened prior to the passage of the bill last time was that some school districts were not offering academic opportunities to these students, and in some school districts, they weren't even allowing these students to participate in high school completion activities with their class. And that's a positive thing that happened out of the bill last time, is now every school district in the state must allow a student that's completing high school, even with a certificate of attendance, to be able to walk or roll across the stage with their class in recognition of the years of investment that they've made in education and their progress. So what this bill would do is create what would be a very high standard, a very high bar for students with the most significant learning challenges to meet. Some might argue that this sets a bar that's too low, but the eligibility to get this extended diploma is that beginning in middle school, you have to be taking two or more modified assessments in order to be able to try to achieve this diploma. And what it does is it requires that these students, and it gives parents, we've heard a lot from parents, a tool when they're talking with their school districts to say, my goal for my child who may have a significant developmental disability is to achieve this extended diploma. And as a result, this child needs to be given access to literacy instruction or to social studies instruction. And I think that that is something that actually raises expectations for this population of students and will improve their educational experience in the school system.
Madam Chair.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you. So, Representative Gelser, would this be a tool in IEP meetings for the parent to be able to get on record? I plan for my child to be working through their school career on an extended diploma or am I kind of tracking how that might be used?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, that's how it would be used. And if I could share a story, I mean, where this came from, I became aware of this not only from working with families, but from my own experience being the parent of a child with a developmental disability. When it came time for my family to transition our child from the fifth grade to the sixth grade in middle school, I went to the middle school and wanted to figure out how we were going to support him in his science classes and his language arts classes. And what I was told was that because he was going to middle school and he was never going to graduate from high school, we needed to start working on vocational types of programs. And I was told what would happen for him during the day was that he would help sweep the floors in the hallway. They would do the laundry for the lost and found. And every day after lunch, the students with developmental disabilities that were in the class he was going to be in would put on gloves and aprons and dig through the garbage cans to pull out recyclables so that they could learn how to make money. And this was not acceptable to me, and one of the reasons that was given to me was because he would never graduate, and these kids wouldn't ever graduate, and we needed to do these vocational things. And he can learn, as can many other students. We successfully, there were many changes. I was actually a school board member at the time that this happened, and a legislator. So when you hear those stories that we've heard from families, I believe them, because I heard those things too. But I did advocate, and that did not happen. He is included in regular classes, as are now all of the other students in that particular life skills class, and nobody is putting on aprons and gloves and digging through garbage cans for recyclables. And that was a systems change in that school district.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mayor.
For the record, did you become the parent from heck?
As a school board member, I felt the obligation to remain polite. But when my son was younger, there actually is a Eugene chapter of Mothers from Hell, and I did inquire about membership. I never did join. And I think that there are constructive ways. And to the credit of the district, what happens is people are often very fearful, and they don't have many tools. I was not fearful, and I raised it, and the superintendent was extraordinarily responsive. And we did make changes that impacted not just my child, but all of these children. And as he's taking academic classes, we're starting to see what the benefit is of his being there. He can tell you all about a salmon run. He can tell you about pollution in rivers. He is in a chemistry class, but even I thought this is probably too abstract for him. But a couple of weeks ago, he came to me with the penny that they turned, or the dime that they turned into a copper color, and he started to explain to me that if you put it in the chemical and the atoms start bouncing around really fast, it changes the color. And this is a child whose IQ scores put him in the range of moderate mental retardation. These kids can learn if they have access to these academic programs. And that's what this bill, as I've introduced it, is about. It says that they can strive to achieve this type of a diploma, that school districts must offer these academic opportunities to these kids, even if they have low IQ scores, and that they have a goal that they can reach for, that's something more than a certificate of attendance. Because these kids work hard, and parents, if they know they have this option, it gives them a tool, it gives them something to hold on to where they can make progress. So I had, as the chair of this committee, I decided not to schedule this bill, because we've been working on a lot of things, and frankly, we've been doing a lot of special education things, and it seemed like one more was too many. But when I was looking for a relating clause, this one popped up, because as we listened to testimony on the Oregon School for the Blind, one of the consistent messages we heard, and we heard it also when we went on the tour of the School for the Blind, was that students, one of the reasons that the students at the school aren't achieving diplomas is that if they get a diploma, a modified diploma or a regular diploma, they then would no longer be eligible for transition services, those 18 to 21 services. And since you've all lived this committee for the last 2 months, I don't have to explain to you why those transition services are so important for these students to be independent growing older. And I went to look at that. I had in my mind that was a federal issue, and actually it's not. That is a policy decision that the state of Oregon made. So the relating clause in this bill is relating to the completion of high school. And with your guidance, I would either like to stuff this bill with an amendment that says achieving a high school diploma or a modified diploma does not exclude you from transition services in Oregon, or keep the body of this basic bill and add that on as an amendment to it, because you could do both within this relating clause. I think the benefit to addressing that issue for the transition services for 18 to 21, as we talk about our 2040-40 plan, it makes no sense that we have a policy that says to kids, you must make the active choice to not achieve a diploma in order to get the educational services that you need and are entitled to under federal law. Making this change in law would allow us to do that. It shouldn't be a fiscal impact because the students are getting the services from 18 to 21, but what they're paying is their school completion, is their diploma, or could be their modified diploma. This, to me, seems like a win-win-win for everyone to correct what was a bad policy choice for the state. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Roble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this would change it for any of the diploma programs then as well, so this last amendment. So if I got a regular diploma, but there was still a need, and the example for me would be the School of the Blind. I'm in a regular program. I get a regular diploma because I have done everything that I need to get a regular diploma. But now I need to get transition services from that 17 to 21, and it would still be available to me, which we couldn't do before.
Correct. Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, yes.
Follow-up. I just want to thank you for finding that, because I've always been told it was federal as well. So I am truly pleased that we can change this by, wherever you have to put it, I will be there with you to put it in. And the only other thing I would comment on is the degree you're putting in this bill for these special needs children. The extended one, or are we going back and changing the definition of modified and extend to extended, and then modified stays the one? So I wasn't quite sure when I would.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I spoke really fast. When I woke up this morning, I had not planned to promote keeping the body of this bill, but around 10 o'clock this morning, I was reminded how important this bill was to me last session, and I didn't want to just let it go. The idea is we would maintain the modified diploma as we passed last session, as the Department of Ed defined it. I think that is serving a population of students, and I have no bad feelings about that. I'm glad we were able to fill another need. I was just disappointed that it was not consistent with the legislative intent. What this would do would then add basically a third diploma option. You'd have a regular diploma, a modified diploma, and an extended diploma. And this is not a special ed diploma, because that is against the law. So there's nothing in this that says you must be on an IEP. And I did contact the Federal Special Education Office, and they informed me that this would be that using the eligibility criteria, being taking the extended assessments or the modified assessments, would be legal. And that's the way that you make sure you're not lowering the standard for another population of students.
Follow up. So I guess my question on that one is, are there any students who are taking extended testing or the modified testing who aren't on an IEP?
Right.
Or does it matter? Because sometimes the question isn't whether it does, but when we look at it, are those the only people that get it? Then all of a sudden, from federal law, it becomes, you may not say that it's doing it, but it does it, therefore it's not legal. So,
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I don't know the answer to that question. There are a variety of reasons why a student might take a modified assessment. My argument would be that the information that I got back from the feds was that this would be legal, and this is a place where we can help these students increase their achievement and make sure that we're giving them more opportunity rather than less.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe several things here. Along those lines, is there a possibility this could put the school district regarding AYP testing, whatever, could it put them in a precarious situation by having another allowable diploma? And then how would the school meet the No Child Left Behind or any other criteria for testing along that? Would your son, for example, have to then, by accepting in the IEP that he's working toward an extended diploma, would there be a level then that he would have to be proficient at?
Right.
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, that's a very good question. I do not believe so. Right now, unfortunately, the great benefit of the No Child Left Behind Act, and I do like this part, is that it disaggregates data and it helps us see how children with disabilities, Latino students, and other students are faring in our public school districts. And what we see from that is we have a lot more work to do for our students with disabilities. So I would take my son in particular. He, even though with his disability, he is not able to hold a pencil and he has several grade levels behind, his disability does not fall within that extraordinary range that exempts him from testing. So he has to sit through that testing just so he can be told again that he is not at grade level, which is something that we all knew, and it counts against his school district because he doesn't meet AYP. I mean, he can't. He just can't. And that's the problem with NCLB, because that's frustrating for him and for his teachers. This won't make that problem worse. What this does, and he's not receiving a diploma anyway, and the modified diploma and the extended diploma, my understanding is they do not count as school leaving certificates, and I think that's what the safety net is here, and we had this discussion last time. If there's a modified diploma, does that create a back door, a safety hatch for school districts to shuttle kids off onto an easier diploma and not do their job to hold them to the higher standard? Where they're getting held at, then again, is that AYP and the number of kids that they're graduating out.
Follow up?
Yes.
I like the idea, and I like the amended idea. In the body of the bill, you're comfortable then with the way you had it written. And as far as, and I didn't read the whole thing here quickly, I'm not a speed reader, but you basically targeted math and English mm-hmm. on page one. And is there anything additional in the body to science or anything else, or are you focusing on those two and the board that's listed in here? Is that the local school board or the Board of Education or ODE, or who would then come up with, or would it be up to the parent and the IEP team to come up with the criteria for the extended diploma?
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, if you look on page 2 for the bill, this is what's different from the bill last time. This mm-hmm. bill spells out actually what the criteria mm-hmm. are, and so while in grade 9 through the completion of high school, the student must complete at least 12 credits, and again, that sounds like a low number, but that is a very high number for this population of students, many of whom are currently getting no credits, which may not include more than 6 credits earned in a self-contained special education classroom. It would include 2 credits of math, 2 credits of English, 2 credits of science, 3 credits of history, geography, economics, or civics, a credit of health, a credit of PE, and a credit of the arts or a second language. And as you go through in, you can talk that their participation, they can earn their credit through modified materials in that classroom.
Thank you.
So there's not a lot of leeway left in here for rulemaking.
Representative Culp. Thank you, Chair. Chair Gelser, I really like this bill. And yet, the only question I really have after the other questions have been asked, so then if a person, as defined there on page 2, has a significant learning or instructional barrier or have documented history, so then somewhere there's going to be documentation and a plan developed so that... Yeah, it's just like, just clarify what is the process a little bit more.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Comp. The first thing is that parents must be informed that this is available to them.
Right.
I'm trying to find where that is at in here. Most of the language is similar to what it was last time, and maybe some of this part was, I'm skimming.
Page two, line four.
Yes. Yes. So they have to satisfy the requirements. Basically, it's going to be an IEP team that here it is on page three, line 10. A school district or public charter school shall ensure that students have access to appropriate resources to achieve a high school diploma, a modified diploma, an extended diploma, or an alternative certificate at each high school in the district or at the public charter school. Provide literacy instruction to all students until graduation, which I think is a very key and important piece of this bill. And beginning in grade 5, annually provide information to the parents or guardians of a student taking an alternate assessment of the availability of a modified diploma, an extended diploma, and an alternative certificate and the requirements. So, and then the requirement is participate in alternate assessments in at least two assessment areas beginning no later than the sixth grade. And that's intended. We're not going to catch someone that's fallen behind. We're truly catching those kids that inherently have significant learning challenges that have persisted throughout school despite appropriate interventions.
Okay. Any other questions?
And so my question is, when I put the amendment in, would it be the sense of the committee that you would like a gutting and stuffing of just the transition piece, or might I keep the bill and have the transition piece as an add-on?
Keep the bill add-on.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Hepburn.
As I stated, I think I like the body of the bill the way it is, with and then just the amendment.
Okay.
For me.
Representative Van Orman, did you have something?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree. Keep the bill and add on.
Thank you.
There you go.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry. Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At what point, there's no fiscal at all attached to this now.
Correct.
And there would be before it comes back and we get a vote.
Yes, we would have the appropriate documentation.
Okay, because I am concerned about the additional testing, the additional facilities, et cetera, that may be required here. I'm also, it's not quite clear to me what the extended and the modified diploma, since I wasn't here before for the modified diploma conversation and all, exactly what those, the distinctions that each of those conveys upon the recipient.
And
so I'd hope we don't have to answer all of that right now, but I would want to know going forward.
And Madam Chair, Representative Parker, the one thing I would clarify, there's no new testing that's in here. It goes to the way that we're doing our state assessments of the kids right now. So there would be no new testing would come as a result of the bill.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Springer. So my assumption was we're already doing this, except we don't have this special diploma.
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, yes. Everything in the process would remain the same, except for we would give students a new school completion option. Think of it in a college, it's a new degree, except we don't have to offer new classes. You just have to offer access to classes to these students.
Anything else? Did you get your question answered?
I did.
Thank you. And while Representative Gelser is returning to the dais, we have Ellen Fisher, if you would like to come forward to testify. And I just ask that you would start by stating your name, please.
Sure. My name is Ellen Fisher. I live in Aloha, Oregon. My children have attended the Beaverton School District. I'm a parent of three children there. My oldest is a sophomore, just completed sophomore year at Brigham Young University in molecular biology. He was a TAG student. I have a 20-year-old who went through the special education program, and I have a 14-year-old who will be a freshman this September at Aloha High School, who's also in the special education program. I guess I should also ask, is 5 minutes too much to ask? I don't know what your time limits are.
You're good for five.
That's okay. Good. I just found out about this bill this morning, so I'm here to give you my information. My concerns are, I've just finished my child's 8th grade IEP and contacted her high school and discovered that this new situation exists with a modified diploma. Now my 20-year-old got a modified diploma. The way he got through high school was barely attending. I had to formulate my own educational program for him. By the time he became a senior, he was so emotionally destroyed by the educational system that what we did is offered him school hours for working hours. When he was in sixth grade, they didn't know what to do with him, so they sent him to a behavioral school, and it just sent a downward spiral that just destroyed the student. So I don't want to see that happen to my 14-year-old. So here are my concerns about this, and I just got a copy of the bill today, and so I have a lot of work to do on this, but I have a couple of concerns about, number one, what grandfathering will be considered for these students. I understand some of these requirements are 2014, and some of them go to 2012, so I'm concerned about, as a parent, what happens with kids who are starting right now into this. When does all this affect them? And actually, my school district could not tell me much about this program. They don't know yet. They couldn't return my calls because they don't yet know all the details. So I'm taking this bill and what I found about the modified diploma to them so they can at least study it and get an idea. But if we're implementing this in September, how are we going to get to that point? I'm very concerned. I'm also not sure exactly how all these modifications are going to affect these kids. I have a daughter who emotionally has done very well. She's now at fifth grade math level as an outgoing eighth grader. She's done very well emotionally at the school for the first time in her life. She was actually being abused by other students in the fifth grade. So I called the team specialist to come in and find out what her problems were, and they sent her to an SEC classroom, which is a high-level autism program. And she's done very well emotionally. I think because of that, I have great hope as a mother that she will actually be a productive member of society now. But here's a big concern for me. The school says because of the algebraic requirements, she will then go to her freshman year, be sent into the algebra classroom. Last night, she couldn't do the problem. 3 goes into 700. Didn't understand where to start. So she's got to go to the algebra classroom, fail for one semester, then they will pick up a remedial class that she can then attend. And so I have some educational concerns as well about what classes we're offering the kids who are going for this. And my school also didn't understand the team idea. Maybe if we said to them it's an IEP team, essentially, they would understand that. But they didn't understand that a team is required in this bill, that the parent is part of that team, and then we all get together like we do in an IEP, and we decide what path we're going on. So when I went to her counselor and said, I expect my daughter to get a modified diploma, I know her limitations, then they said, well, here are the new changes proposed for the modified diploma. I just want to make sure that my child has a place to get a diploma. That's where I'm coming from. And if you have any questions for me as a parent, I've been through it all with these kids.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Oh, still have a gavel. Okay.
Didn't want to give it up.
Somewhat off topic, in your IEP meetings, mm-hmm. can you briefly describe that relationship that you have as a parent with the IEP team?
Oh, that's vital for me that I be right on top of things. As a matter of fact, I called my child's teacher today and said, there's this new bill, you gotta get the information. We get together and we discuss, they propose what they think are her strengths and abilities and where they think she can go, and then they ask me, do you feel like this is on track as a parent? So, like I have her current IEP, it says exactly how much time she is to have for extra literary needs, for social skills, and these kinds of things. We work very well as a team, but I'm a parent that believes, I have to tell you as well, I was here when the bill for the SIM and CAM came out. I came and gave testimony in favor of that. The only thing I'm disappointed with is we don't have the vocational program in place. I think that's really sad because our children need that. And along with this, maybe something else can be done to help promote vocationally for these kids who are going to be great members of society if we keep them emotionally secure. So for me to work with the team, the IEP team, is just critical for my children to succeed in school.
Paula?
Yes.
What would happen if you objected to their proposal?
Objected to, I'm sorry?
To the IEP, to the team's proposal?
I'm very fortunate that I have a good relationship with them. If I were to object what they were proposing, I could say I'm not quite sure I accept this. Let's go back and rethink this. My daughter actually was this year taking regular testing. Now I look at the bill and it says in eighth grade she has to have had the modified testing. So that's something I'm concerned about, that we need to be informed about now as parents of eighth graders, that in order to get this modified, they really should have this other testing, alternative testing. That's one thing I have been having a concern with, and now I see why. Yeah.
Representative Huffman.
Madam Chair, and this is probably for Representative Gelzer, because I think maybe I was the first one that said IEP. I'm not sure at this point, and so maybe I assumed, and I don't want to do that. My assumption was that a student would have to have an IEP. Is that maybe not quite correct?
That is not correct, because this is not a special education diploma, so you would not see an IEP team that's spelled out either in the law or in the rule, because if it required the IEP team to make the diploma decision, then you would have to be a special education student, and you do not have to be eligible for IDEA services
to be eligible to pursue one of these different school leaving certificates. You just have to meet, you know, the eligibility requirements for the modified diploma are a little bit looser. These are very stringent, that you must participate in alternate assessments in at least two assessment areas beginning no later than the sixth grade and lasting for more than two assessment cycles.
Follow up. Would there be, can you give me an example of a student that and parents that may want to opt for a extended diploma that didn't have an IEP?
No.
Okay, so it was a fair assumption.
Yeah, so what's some comp can?
I can give you a real easy one. A student comes into a school district, he's in eighth grade, 12 to 13 years old, has never been taught English or math in their native language, and then is expected to get a diploma in 4 to 5 years in our regular traditional system. And so not whether the student you don't even have a chance to figure out if he has a learning disability or anything else. So there's a time span there that you need to have to work with a student to figure that out, and that student may well have some needs that we're not aware of, or they might progress on a normal scale. So those things, and they wouldn't be on an identified individual education plan. They would just be monitored through the system with assessments and teachers working with the parents saying, okay, how do you think this is going?
Thank you. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I want to follow along the same line, so don't think we're ignoring you.
Okay.
My feeling then is a team could be the IEP team. It wouldn't be called an IEP team. It could include the same people, but it could also include different people if you want to have the counselor and so on. At some point, once it's selected, it could actually be part of the IEP team to be put into the IEP, that this is what we're working for because we've all agreed outside in this other team. Does that sound fair? Okay. I would agree with that one. And my other question, I just want to thank you for being here and coming. I think that most of this to most people is abstract because they haven't had a child. It's never abstract to the parent. They know exactly what it is that they're trying to get to for their individual child. And we as school people know that it is individual children that we're working with.
And my children are my full-time job. I've done this my whole life, and this is what I do, and this is what I'm going to do. And
yeah, so thank you for that.
You're very welcome. I appreciate your time, and I really appreciate Representative Comp's comment, because my 20-year-old was just a couple of months ago diagnosed with Asperger's. He has a ton of other diagnoses, but that's a new one that we have. So how do we know in this educational process at what point the kids are going to get these diagnoses? So we know we can see them in the schools. We know they have problems, but maybe the parents or maybe the medical community can't quite get it together in time. And I believe this program will help those students. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, Mrs. Fisher, don't rush off yet. You're very popular.
Okay,
Representative Gelser.
Okay.
And I wanted to directly answer one of the concerns that you raised, which was about how might it impact kids that are already in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that's important. This doesn't change the new modified diploma that was put into place. This just adds a third option. So the new program that's being implemented, the new modified diploma that's now available, that would not be messed with by this bill. This just becomes a new option. And the point of it being going into effect immediately is that for the kids that are currently leaving school, that they immediately start to understand that this is going to be available to them. And I think that I guess this is kind of a conflict of interest statement, and I want to be, and one of the reasons I've given the gavel to Representative Springer is this is a deeply personal issue for me, so I declare that conflict of interest. But timing makes a difference for these kids, and I know that for our family, kind of where my change in opinion came between 10 o'clock this morning and noon today, was that that my son isn't the only one, but he's one kid that I know that if we don't pass this session, he will not have the opportunity to get anything except for a certificate of attendance. And that's very frustrating. And it's frustrating not just for him, but for all of those other kids that are working really hard at school every day and should have something that they can reach for.
Representative Comp.
Well, the other comment, thank you, Chair. Along with that, when we set a standard of bar of continued growth and literacy, we have students that know that they're not being successful in their class. But this also says we're not going to give up.
Okay. I was wrestling with a question, but I don't think so. Anything else? Any other questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time. I really
appreciate
it
very much.
So,
I'd love to do that. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on this bill that hasn't signed up before we close this work session or public hearing?
Can I make one more statement?
Sure.
I do want to make one more statement, and that came up because of what the questions that Representative Gelser got, and I think the one that I think a lot of people don't always understand, because I too appreciate No Child Left Behind's disaggregation of data so that we can know what different groups are doing. But one of the ones that has been the most frustrating to me as when I was in school was the whole idea that one of those subgroups is these people, students with IEPs. Because the goal of the testing, and you have to report if you didn't make the goal, is that you're at grade level and that you're completing at these levels. In order to have an IEP, you have to be below levels, at least in some of your coursework, most of which are tested. So if you met the IEP goal, you wouldn't be able to continue to be on an IEP if you met the AYP goal, i.e., I'm at grade level, when by definition you're defined as needing these services because you're at least two grade levels behind. So this is one of those perfect catch-22s that happens in some of our legislation, which keeps making people take these tests, and they surprisingly show up that they're below the level, when in fact that's why they are identified, is because they are below the level. And so they continue not to perform, and they continue to get this information back that they've done something wrong, when in fact they have done nothing wrong. It's just the setup that was setting them up. And I think sometimes people don't quite understand that with our setting these AYP goals. They give some outs for school districts to show that if they've actually started to improve, they can do some things, but the basic testing sets people up who have learning disabilities to not be able to get there.
Thank you. So do you want me to close the public hearing? Okay. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2507.
Right, and I see that we have Representative Wisnitz, so I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3076. Representative Wisnitz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Honorable committee members, I'm Gene Wisnitz, State Representative, District 53. I'll try to be brief. You have other testimony coming up by parents of talented and gifted. I think this is very appropriate that we just talked about some special students, and now you're going to look at a bill for some other special students. Members, I've been in education since I've been in this building 6 years. My passions are changing the school distribution formula, increasing civics and education, financial education training, literacy, or if you want to call it civic literacy and financial literacy, and TAG. And I'm not having much success in all three of my passions and objectives. But I am glad to bring you this bill today, House Bill 3076, on behalf of talented and gifted parents. When I first got in this building and I heard about this group and how we, the first session I was here in Ways and Means, I found we had a half of FTE at ODE looking after talented and gifted, and that was about it. And we were going through some budget problems then. And so we've tried to make, I've been honored to introduce legislation last session and this session. So what we found out on House Bill with 3076 is that state law requires that every school district develop a written plan for programs and protection for programs and services, but the Department of Education didn't believe that they had the authority to look at these plans or approve them. So that's basically what this bill is doing. It amends existing legislation that requires school districts to submit lesson plans for talented and gifted children. And again, I'm going to expedite my testimony to say that House Bill 3076 will provide families in the Oregon Department of Education with the information they need to ensure that TAG, talented and gifted students, needs are being met, and this will be an increased transparency of the TAG program is achieved and at no cost to the state. So I hope with that statement that will be encouragement to this committee to move this bill.
And Representative Wisnett, you weren't here right at the beginning. We unfortunately did not get back all of the necessary documents today. So please don't be hurt if it doesn't move today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. I have all the confidence that this committee will do everything they can to address this special group of students that we sort of gets left out, and I'm sure you won't do that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I will invite up Sue Love, Margaret DeLacy, and Morgan. I'll call Morgan next.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Susan Love, and I reside in Salem, and I'm a parent and I'm a board member of the Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted. And I'm in here to support House Bill 3076, and I'm going to make this really brief. Representative Wisnett said just about everything that I'm going to say. I know that you have a lot on your plate, and Margaret DeLacy has provided you with a lot of information that I'm sure that you have been reading on this bill. What I'd like to say is this bill will provide clear access to the Oregon Department of Education TAG specialist to the district plans that currently right now they don't feel like they have clear access to. And there is no fiscal impact except for possibly putting a postage stamp if a district decides they want to send in a hard copy. And that is all I would like to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, my name is Margaret DeLacy. I live in Portland, and I'm also a board member of the Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted. Madam Chair, you are not the only person who's had some difficulties with legislation. The passage of the Oregon TAG mandate left some problems with the old parts of the law that weren't corrected when the mandate passed. And we view this bill as essentially a remedy for a drafting error that was made in the past. It's really a housekeeping bill. So rather than take your time with further testimony, I would like to just say that we're here to answer your questions if you have any. I am also distributing some information about TAG spending in the state of Oregon that came to us courtesy of the Department of Education. I'd like to thank them and Senator Wisnett for working with us on this. And I just would say that this shows that districts have, in fact, been neglecting TAG. They have not increased their spending in TAG in a decade. And we would hope that with the specialist that you helped us obtain last session, we will be able to assist the districts in doing a better job with the money they have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Representative Fetcher.
Not necessarily a question, more of a comment. I co-sponsored this bill in honor of my a dear employee who is also an MFH, mother from you-know-what, when it comes to her child and TAG programs. Boy, she is just, well, it's a good thing she's not here, but she would very much support this bill.
Thank you, Representative.
She would make you vote aye. I mean, that's just...
Well, Madam Chair, we're not quite that terrifying, but we'd be very pleased to meet this this woman.
You may have.
Yeah, we've been referred to as potted plants also. It depends on what's going on.
Are there further questions?
One quick question. What happened to a school district that had no TAG students?
That's a poser. I believe that the Oregon TAG mandate requires that every district have a written plan for programs and services. These are not individual student plans. These are plans for how the district will provide these services should it have any such students. It's a district-wide plan. So my guess would be that it still is required to have the plan and therefore would send it in. There are really no penalties. It's just enables the department TAG specialist to ask to see a copy of the plan in case a parent calls with questions about what a district is doing.
Just one quick follow-up. Mm-hmm. The reason I ask the question, because there are school districts that have zero students, two students. Mm-hmm. I mean, so that's why I asked the question.
Mm-hmm.
And it just possible that a district with no students wouldn't have a tag student?
Madam Chair, Representative Moore, all I can say at this point is that the bill before you doesn't make any changes in the law regarding what districts have to do or don't have to do, so this bill wouldn't really address that problem either way. But if the law were interpreted to say that they are required to have plans, then this law would require them to mail their plan.
Representative Springer. Thank you, Madam Chair. I asked this question because this was asked of me from a curriculum director in one of my districts that has a TAG plan and has TAG students. They have more than two students. And she said, she asked me this simple question when I was talking to her about it. She said, how does this make sure or assure that we're doing a better job? And so I would pose that question to you. How does this assure, the idea that we have a plan is good, but how does that assure districts are doing a better job?
Do you want to take that?
I would say that the ODE specialist would be able to look at that plan since it would come in, and they would be able to look at it, and they would be able to alert the school district, I would imagine, about maybe some holes in their plan or also thank them for what they're doing. I mean, that's how I would look at this.
May I answer too? Madam Chair, Representative Springer, the TAG system is a complaint-driven system. And as you see, if you look at the funding information I handed out to you, it is significantly under-resourced, to put it politely. There is nothing in the state that guarantees that these students will receive an appropriate education. I was listening to Representative Roblin earlier speaking about our desire to make sure that every student has access to college preparatory curriculum. I come from Portland, and I can say that even in Portland, that is not the case even for TAG students right now. This bill will not really solve those problems, but it will at least give our new TAG specialist additional tools to work with districts that want help. So we see it as a step forward, but not as a solution.
And may I make another comment? And that is, a lot of times she receives the phone calls from parents wondering about school districts, either they're going to move into the area or they're having problems. She would be able to pull out what's there and be able to look at and be able to assist both the school district and the parents.
May I say one more thing? I was at
the chair now.
Yeah, one more. We've got a couple more questions, and then we've got to move on.
I was at a conference organized by the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators yesterday. It was a wonderful conference. I was very impressed by it. And a couple of administrators came up to me and said, you know, we really think this is a good idea. They distributed the bill to all those people there because it would give us some more help in deciding whether we're doing a good job or not, and we're really looking for some more help.
Great. Thank you very much. Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is along the lines of what you're talking about. This bill will give the specialist not only some tools that will help her to react to issues, but some sort of statewide vision, no? And ways perhaps to be more proactive. I mean, I would assume that's part of the underlying goal, or at least I would hope so.
Madam Chair, Representative Dimbrough, that would certainly be our hope.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you both very much.
Thank you very much.
Morgan. Welcome back. It's never a real education committee without you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, for the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education. Just to reiterate a couple things, and I hope this does not disrupt your audio and visual recording equipment, because I don't think I've said this before this session, but this bill does have no fiscal impact, and we certainly can't absorb this work within our existing resources, so I hope that doesn't foul things up. But
it doesn't even go, it doesn't even go into the sponge?
Your sponge is big enough.
We don't even need a sponge for this one. But yes, just to reiterate a couple things, we support the bill. It's a great bill. Our our TAG specialist is actually at that same COSA conference that the previous testifiers were speaking to. So I'm in here in lieu of her. And I think what Representative Dembrow hit on is exactly what she asked me to convey to this committee, is that, you know, some quirk in the law, the districts are not required to send us their TAG plans. They're required to do one. We have some of them, I believe. Some of them are sent in. But it'll just, now that we have a full-time person at our department to deal with TAG stuff, it really is a resource for her to be proactive, sort of see what different districts are doing when other school districts call in and say, you know, we're redoing our TAG plan or we need some information, and it will allow her to share sort of best practices and all those kinds of things that I think we hope we can do when this change gets put into place. So, you know, I think ultimately the result is hopefully our goal is that it will help strengthen some of the programs and allow us to share best practices and allow our new staff person to be more proactive working with school districts early on in case before they have problems.
Thank you very much. Representative.
You remember that show, Welcome Back, Cotter? I'm going to have to be down here because you ignore me. I'm going,
Do I ignore you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Morgan, quick question, and I'm not being facetious, but I am curious because we require a lot of plans, and I'm supportive before Margaret throws tomatoes at me. What's the definition of written plan? Is there an ODE definition of written plan, or can it be as simple as three pages?
Madam Chair and Representative Huffman, I'm not super familiar with the TAG statute, but I believe there's components of it that have to be, that are in statute and probably in rule that you would have to include, and I can look that up and get that information from Stacy Figgins, our TAG person, and bring that back. Or maybe the folks in the back could nod and help me out, but I believe there are certain components you have to have. So.
Great.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Do you
view this as being onerous to any small districts or anything, or is this?
No. Madam Chair and Representative Huffman, again, it's required by law currently. They're supposed to have the TAG plans in place, and essentially all they're doing is sharing them with us. Again, many of them, I'm sure we have many of them and we see many of them, but it would just require them to send them to us, and sort of we would have a central repository where our person could respond to questions from other districts and parents, and then also, and I think, I don't remember which member of the committee mentioned, but sort of a lay of the land perspective, it sort of gives her a bigger view of what's going on. So, thanks.
Thank you very much, Morgan. And colleagues, as I mentioned, we don't have the documentation on this bill yet, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3076 and carry the work session for open a work session on House Bill 3076. We're carrying the work session on House Bill 3076 over to Monday, the 20th is the number, so we're holding that over till the 20th, closing the work session on House Bill 3026, and opening a public hearing on HJM 15. And we have about 10 to 12 minutes on this one.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, before you is HJM 15. This memorial provides that the 75th Legislative Assembly urges Congress to pass legislation and appropriate the necessary funds to provide a free college education for every academically qualified U.S. citizen.
Great. And Mike Sullivan, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Madam Chair, my name is Mike Sullivan. I'm the political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, commonly known as the AWPPW. I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing this joint memorial to be heard before the Education Committee. I know this committee's had a full agenda, so I appreciate the time. I would like to also add that I'm happy that I got some of your committee to sign on. Actually, I got a majority. And I hope that helps. And I even got Representative Greenlick, who's in the audience, who told me in 05 that memorials aren't worth, well, I'll let him explain that.
I assume that's why he's here. This is the vote you're here for, right, Representative
Greenlick? I hope not.
Priority memorial.
I would also like to thank Representative Peter Buckley and his staff, Andrew, on the quest of this since 205 I've been on. I haven't been able to find a sponsor until Representative Peter Buckley came along. So where did this concept come from? It came from a 16-year-old dropout who joined the military in 1943 to fight in World War II. His name was Tony Mizaki, and I glad to say that I met him three times in his life. When he got out of the Army, he heard of this 5220 Club, which was one of the benefits of the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, commonly known as the GI Bill. How it worked, the 5020 Club, was the government provided the GIs with $20 a week for up to 52 weeks to go to college. At this time, the $20 was two-thirds of the average take-home pay of a worker. It was portable. You could go to school, you could stop, you could then go back to school, and you could also do this over a period of years. Tony Mazzocchi had a dream that this wonderful benefit would come to all Americans. He called it free for all. He would preach it wherever he would go, even until his death from cancer. In January of 2002, he was traveling to get more support for Free for All. Clutched in his hand was one of his favorite books, When Dreams Come True, The GI Bill and the Making of Modern America, by Michael J. Bennett. Tony died October 5th, 2002. We need to reinvest in the middle class that was achieved by the GI Bill of 1944, because we are losing it, Madam Chair. And as you and your committee know well, higher education is not very affordable today. The lowest income families today spend far more of their income to send a kid to college. And many low-income students who have to work full-time never realize their dream of a degree. When those families, even the families that do have more, have to stretch it to provide financial help for their children. My wife and I have taken out college loans for our two children that now are adults, and we're still paying on them. And we have a soon-to-be 17-year-old who will be off to college soon. Page two. Madam Chair, there is no free lunch, and over time this concept for free-for-all will pay dividends in realized income and taxes which come from that income. From the ashes of the old come the new. In that light, I hope that this committee and you, Madam Chair, will think of this dream of a 16-year-old dropout and help Tony Mazzocchi's dream become a reality for future higher education for children and grandchildren. Please pass out HJM 15 with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, and I will answer any questions that may come up.
Madam Chair?
Hi, Representative Huffman.
Just quickly, Mike, would you say with all of your heart that this would fit into the governor's 40-40-20 plan?
Madam Chair?
That's a setup.
Representative Horowitz, I'm not quite sure what that 40-40 is, so I can't answer that.
Let me just say I think it fits perfectly into the 40-40-20.
Andrew.
Go on. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Ainsworth. I'm here on behalf of Representative Buckley. Apologize for rushing in late, but I was trying to reschedule a few meetings for the good co-chair before he left town. So I'm just here to lend Representative Buckley strong support to House Joint Memorial 15. We think it's a wonderful concept, and we're happy that Mr. Sullivan brought it forward. And the only thing I would like to highlight from the memorial is that for every dollar invested in the GI Bill, we receive back $6.90 in return investment in our economy. And so, it's a wonderful concept, and we do hope that you might, pass it out. As Mike noted, it does have broad bipartisan support, and a majority of the committee members have co-sponsored it. So that's all I have.
Thank you. Any further questions for this panel? Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, who else is testifying on this?
This is it.
This is it. Okay. I do have concerns. The GI Bill was not a gift. I mean, these, for the most part, gentlemen, saved our country for all intents and purposes. This was not a free college education. They earned that college education. So I'm actually not supportive of it because it shouldn't be free. At some point, you have to earn what you get. I have no problem if there's a payback to it, and that's Well, go ahead.
If I might respond, you know, one of the great things that President Obama has, you know, been pushing since he took presidency is, you know, renewed service to your country in whatever form possible that, you know, you can give, whether it be, you know, in the armed forces or community service, Peace Corps, Merit Corps, you know, things like that. So, you know, this is a memorial. It's not a bill. You know, we're not setting up the criteria for all of this, just indicating, you know, the legislature's support to Congress, and I understand you may not support it in its current form, but, you know, that is a good point to bring up, and perhaps incorporating that sort of thing into it, you know, would have been good. Unfortunately, we don't have much time to amend the bill and that, you know, or resolution or memorial and move it forward. But
one follow-up, Madam Chair, and
yes.
Then I will stop. And that is... Yet number 8, line 8, whereas the 21st century college education is a prerequisite for effective labor force participation. I mean, I'm sorry, but you don't have to have a college degree to have a successful life. And I don't think we value our electricians and plumbers and heavy equipment operators in this country because we have a mentality that everybody has to be a college graduate, and if you aren't, you are a failure in life, and in fact, that is not true, and we need all these people. And so I don't want to leave out the 40-20 that don't achieve that. So this is coming.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Representative Maurer. I fit the criteria of a trifecta. I am a tradesman, I am a veteran, and I am a college graduate. And I really don't think knowing Tony Mazzecchi's intent and also him as a veteran was meaning any ill respect for veterans. His point was social conscious, that education should be portable, affordable, and available. And by higher education, the intent is trade school and the like. It isn't just for 4-year degrees. I think we all know that 25% of the college graduates are college graduates in this country, and the majority of them do not serve their endeavors of an employment in their major. So by no means is this to show any disrespect to any veteran. I know I am one.
Thank you. Any one last?
Yes, I just have a quick thing to say, Madam Chair, if I could. I think that what the GI Bill, the success of the GI Bill demonstrated was precisely the payback to society of investing in higher education, giving people that access. And, I'm really proud of the philosophy behind this and really applaud you, Mike. I carried this resolution to the AFT National Convention a few years ago. It was really an honor to do so, and I look forward to be able to vote for it today.
Thank you all.
Can I respond to that, Madam Chair?
Briefly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Representative Dembrough, you did take it to the AFT nationally. And I brought it to the AFL-CIO in Oregon before that. So AFT, has endorsed it not only in Oregon but nationally.
Thank you very much. Thank you both. Colleagues, what's your pleasure? Should we move to a work session? All right, so I'm going to close
Representative Maurer. I don't know what your plans are, Madam Chair, but I do. It says college education, and I would prefer a language like college or college and vocational or
post-secondary.
Actually, correct. Post-secondary education might be a better word, and so I would hope we could amend it and make it more broad.
Okay. Where did Andrew go? Would that be acceptable with Representative Buckley? Do you guess? Yes. And would you please reintroduce yourself? It's been so long.
I know. For the record, Andrew Ainsworth for Representative Buckley. I'm sure we'd be fine amending it. We just weren't sure about the committee's timeline, whether or not it had to be today or in the future. So, yes, I'd be happy to submit amendments to Legislative Council.
I think under our 7-day deadline, if we get it in today, we should be able to have it back, and I can't imagine the word would make a significant difference in the fiscal impact of the resolution. Representative Van Orman?
Madam Chair, on line 10, it does say the lack of post-secondary education. So I don't know if that is sufficient, if we needed more than that.
In line 14.
Line 10,
whereas the lack of access by growing numbers of Americans to post-secondary education severely limits.
I think the concern was in line 8.
Madam Chair, if I might, I like the direction that Representative Maurer was headed. If it's not a problem, I would like to move that direction. I vote to go that direction because it does fit, and I think Representative Denbro would agree, it fits more with our workforce plan also. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yes, I would encourage that.
Okay, thank you. So, Andrew, can you maybe connect up with Representative Maurer and get that amendment put in today?
Yeah, I can go ahead and drop it as soon as I get back up to the office.
That's great. Is that acceptable, just changing that word? Is that
delete college and add post-secondary in line 8?
Well, I would also do it to
wherever
to line 30. Yeah, wherever it shows up.
And Madam Chair, the other issue is free. I mean, it assumes that now it becomes an entitlement. At some point in your life, you've got to earn what you get. And, you know, as you enter adulthood, you think there's this transition of we're going to expect something for the freeness of it all. So I'm not quite sure how you put that in there. And I don't know if that really goes against the intent of it. But
it might.
Okay.
Yep.
I don't have a question.
Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You will see that I have signed on to this bill. And Representative Maurer brought up two incredibly good points. One was line 8 that's been addressed, so I won't belabor that. And the other is the comparison of the GI Bill. And there's a huge cost paid there. And so I do have some reservations. I guess I want to get that on record. And certainly I realize it's a memorial. It's not a bill. I'm still wrestling with the lack of definition there. College education, is that my PhD? And so anyway, I just want to put some of those concerns on record.
Well, and I appreciate the thoughtful conversation. I'm aware that we have a representative in the room that we left waiting the other week, so I'd like to start him on time. I think the one last comment I would make in that line 23 to 26, I didn't read that as a comparison between this and the GI Bill. I read that as a reference to what happened when you provided a college education to a population, what the economic benefit of that was over time. But I trust Andrew has heard the discussion and will bring us an appropriate amendment so that we can move this bill forward.
All right.
Many thanks to the co-chair and all of the sponsors. I know there's been a lot of energy put into this, so thank you very much for bringing it forward. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Joint Memorial 15. And how do we keep this alive? You just need to... Do you want to post it for a work session for next Friday?
Madam Chair, there's a couple ways. I suppose we could go into work session and do the carryover. I think the cleanest way of doing it would be to post it either for Friday, the following Friday, a week from now, or Monday, depending upon the Chair's choice, as just a straight-up work session.
Will you please post that for Friday?
We need to post it today.
Yes. We need to post it today for Friday.
Oh, yes.
This is the point before we move into Representative Greenlick for True Confessions. I made an error. I opened the work session on House Bill 2944 at the beginning, not noting that we said we weren't going to open it until after 2 o'clock. It was before 2 o'clock, so that work session didn't count, and we now can't open another one. So will you post this for next Wednesday?
This will be, yes,
okay. Sir. So we will post that for a work session next Wednesday. I apologize for the error. And So I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3118. And Representative Greenlick. Oh, bad pun.
Yeah.
Or a good one. Representative Greenlick, welcome. It's always great to have you in our committee.
I missed this committee. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3118. I appreciate you hearing it, and I even appreciate more you moving it, if you do. This is a very simple bill. It says that an Oregon university, when hiring a head football coach, needs to interview one or more minority applicant when hiring a head football coach unless the institution is bound by contract to promote a member of the institution's current coaching staff. It sounds simple, it sounds trivial, but you're going to hear, I think, some significant testimony that talks about how important this is, both symbolically for the nation and practically for Oregon. As an example of how practically important it is, I passed out a FoxSports.com article by Rachel Bachman, where in it she quotes the athletic director at Eastern Oregon University, who said specifically, the bill might help his department. I think if qualified minorities know that they were going to have a possibility to interview, they might take a closer look at schools such as ours. That Oregon has this law and there's an opportunity there, it might really strengthen our pool of candidates. Now that seems a very important issue, because there is only one way to be hired as a head coach in college, and that's to be a part of the final interview pool. And all you'll hear some information. All our minority coaches are asking is that they get an opportunity to fight for the job that they think they're qualified for. Mr. Zacks and I had talked before, but I was really intrigued watching the Super Bowl, in which a black coach won the Super Bowl. And he was a coach that was hired into a position that was clearly labeled for two assistant coaches of the team. But because of a National Football League rule, they were required to give him an interview. He gave him an interview. He knocked their socks off, and he got the job. And 2 years later, he took a mediocre program to the Super Bowl. In fact, a couple of years ago, there were two black coaches in the Super Bowl competing with each other. I believe there are more black coaches among the teams of the National Football League than there are entirely in Division I football in this country. And yet, half of the athletes that are in these programs are black. Many, many of the assistant coaches are black or Latino or Samoan or other minorities. And they really deserve an opportunity to make a case for themselves. And with that, I'll stop and let you hear testimony from people who know a lot more about this than I do.
Please.
Good morning or afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the Education Committee. For the record, my name is Sam Sachs, and I'm here today to give testimony on House Bill 3118, also known as the Rooney Rule.
And Mr. Sachs, you can push the microphone just a little bit further back, and we won't get as much interference.
Okay.
Thank you.
It is an honor and privilege to have this opportunity to speak to you on an issue that is close and dear to my heart. It is equally as exciting to be back in the Capitol for the first time since serving as an intern in 2007 with Senator Ava Louise Gordley, a person I am proud to call a friend and a pioneer herself. The lessons I learned from Senator Gordley have helped to bring me here today. I graduated from Portland State University in 2007 with a Bachelor of Science degree in Black Studies, and since then I've become involved in the community I live in Portland, working on issues of race that concern my community. The issue before you today is House Bill 3118, the Rooney Rule. The Rooney Rule was created and implemented in 2003 for the National Football League relating to the hiring practices of NFL teams, head football coaches. The NFL recognized that they were way behind in the interviewing and hiring of minority coaches. A rule was created that required any team hiring a head football coach must interview at least one minority coach before filling the position or face a heavy fine. Since the Rooney Rule has been enacted, minority hiring in the NFL has gone up 22%. And as Representative Greenlick mentioned, in 2007, after 40 years of Super Bowls, Coach Tony Dungy and Lovie Smith became the first two black coaches to coach in the Super Bowl. Coach Dungy became the first black coach to win a Super Bowl. And just this year, Coach Mike Tomlin of the Pittsburgh Steelers became the second black coach to win the Super Bowl and the youngest coach as well. What is significant is that both men are products of a rule that gave them the opportunity they otherwise might not have received to interview for a job they were obviously more than qualified for. In Tomlin's case specifically, the Steelers, as Representative Greenlick mentioned, already had two coaches on their staff, Coach Wisenhut and Coach Grimm, who everyone thought for sure would be likely candidates to lead the Steelers. The Steelers instead slowed down the process, followed the Rooney Rule, and took its time to interview not just minority candidates, but non-minorities as well, to include Wisenhunt and Grimm. The final decision proved that the Rooney Rule works. The Steelers hired Tomlin, the most qualified candidate, and in only his second year as head coach, he led his team to win the Super Bowl. I'm here today out of frustration and inspiration. I've long been frustrated at the hiring process in college football at all levels that continues to overlook, minimize, and disenfranchise an entire group of athletes, coaches, and young men. Many of these same young men that generate the millions of dollars in revenue that an athletic director was quoted as saying today in the Statesman Journal as justification for speeding up the hiring process. Quote, unquote, once in a while we have to protect our bottom line and the ability to move quickly. I'm sorry, but I don't agree with that. In our educational system, our bottom line is and always should be about our students. It should always be about protecting the young men and women that attend our universities to get an education and strive to give back to our communities. The student athletes that give of themselves on and off the field and help to generate that revenue. Our student athletes are the bottom line we should protect. Don't we as educators, community members, and legislators owe it to our students to make sure the playing field is even and equal? I say we do. In 2007, I watched as my university, Portland State, went through the quick process of hiring a football coach. They requested a speedy waiver from the Affirmative Action Office, which gave them permission to go around the Affirmative Action guidelines for hiring. Within a week, they posted the job for a total of 3 days, interviewed two people, and hired their coach. This practice seems to be more the norm than the exception, as Portland State University, again, most recently was granted a speedy waiver in hiring the men's basketball coach. With the Rooney Rule in place, the university can still speed up the process and protect what they call their bottom line, but they'll have to take enough time to reach out and interview at least one qualified minority candidate. I believe this will benefit non-minority applicants as well, who may get an interview if the school takes more time in their search. In today's economic climate, and with the wonderful work the Black Coaches Association is doing, finding that qualified candidate won't be difficult. If for some unforeseen reason a school has difficulty, I offer my services to them free of charge. I know of two coaches right now that are qualified and interested. Some critics of House Bill 3118 have said it's not fair to interview someone based on race instead of someone more qualified. Why do we always use being qualified as an argument against equal rights? Being Black, Samoan, Asian, or Latino doesn't mean you're not qualified. What it does mean, though, according to 58 pages of statistics by the Institute of Diversity and Ethics in Sport and Dr. Richard Lapchick, is that minorities are not always seen as the most qualified. No one should ever be hired based on race, and this bill doesn't say that they should. But they certainly should not be ignored because of it either. This bill will do one simple thing. It will go a long way in protecting our real bottom line. It will give those student athletes that spend 4 or 5 years generating so-called revenue for the universities hope that when their playing days are done and over, they will still be valued and respected as human beings who have so much more to offer than a touchdown or a sack. They will know that the state of Oregon values diversity and equal rights, and that we lead the way in assuring that our students can achieve anything they set their mind on, including coaching the Oregon State Beavers football team.
Speed it up, Sam.
This bill will not disrupt the current hiring practices of Oregon college universities. In fact, as Representative Greenlick mentioned, the Eastmore Athletic Director Rob Cashel was quoted as saying it could strengthen the pool. I don't believe the penalty or fine is needed in this bill. Another critic's leading argument, the State Board of Higher Education already has a system in place to deal with violations. My focus is not to punish schools, but to motivate and encourage them to think outside the box. I believe this bill will send a message across the country and to Oregonians that we value diversity in the state of Oregon. With 120 divisions, Division I programs in college football made up of over 47% African-American athletes, it's embarrassing that only six of those are headed by minority coaches. In closing, I'm inspired as well. I'm inspired by a system that allows me to be here today as a citizen of this wonderful state and be able to bring this issue forward to you for consideration. I'm inspired by the many people that have come forward to support this bill and by the courage, compassion, and understanding Representative Greenlick and Senator Bonamici have shown by sponsoring this bill. I hope they will move this bill forward and send a message on behalf of all Oregonians to the rest of the country and to minority coaches everywhere. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our question, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have no problem with the concept. For 22 years, I lived under FCC rules with the radio station, and we were mandated in our parity of employees. So it wasn't just getting interviews, but we were mandated to have X number of Hispanics and American Indians on the staff because it was based on your county's population. However, in spite of the parity rule that I had to live under, and I hear you say differently, that there will be no problem supplying a qualified candidate for an interview, but in my situation, and we were mandated to aggressively try to get qualified applicants from the Hispanic and American Indian populations, and it was difficult to get, not even qualified, it was difficult to get an applicant for an interview. So, and I see no provision, not a loophole, I'm not looking for loopholes, but I see no provision for a school if they just don't get an applicant for an interview. What happens?
I think this is a part of the affirmative action process of the university system, where we do work under this, and what you need to show if you don't get a qualified applicant under affirmative action, you have to show that you've tried, and here's the way you've done it. You advertise with the Black Football Coaches Association, you did X, Y, Z, and none turned out, and then you get a pass. But that pass ought to happen after you've tried, not before.
Absolutely.
You've tried.
Right.
And we think in this case that there are so many potential candidates, frequently right in the program's own coaching staff.
Representative Springer was next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sam, did we have a conversation on the phone?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I thought we had. And at that point, I think I told you the concept was great, and I'm on board with that. And I did point out one thing in here that gave rise to some concerns. And it is the line, interview one or more minority applicants when hiring a head football coach. And my point to you on that was, there's nothing in here that says the person needs to meet the qualifications. Now, I have never applied for the position of a football coach. However, I have applied over 20 years ago, applied for a lot of cop jobs, and that was still when women were still breaking into that, and I didn't do it to prove a point. I did it because I thought it'd be fun to be a cop, and it was. But my point is, I always had to be qualified, and there was always a job announcement that said, you have to this, 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 and this. And it was very clear. And I darn well expected an interview if I met this, 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 and this, and I passed these tests, and I moved through the process. That was the element that was missing here, but I don't know the hiring process for football coaches. So take care of that concern for me.
Madam Chair and Representative Springer, I don't have a problem with adding the word qualified minority candidate. I think it will do two things.
The Senate, if we can.
I think it will do two things. It will get rid of the criticism that these are just token interviews. And I can assure you that the Black Coaches Association and the individuals that search out candidates make sure that the candidates are qualified before they interview. So I appreciate your input on that, and I could see that happening.
Any state job announcement has the qualifications for the position listed in the job, and these are essentially state university jobs. So they certainly don't have to interview somebody who doesn't meet those qualifications in the job announcement.
Just follow up. That is something that would be very important for me to see in here, because that's a great intent, but it's not reflected here.
Representative Thatcher was first.
Yeah, I was just trying to get clear, Sam. You said there's 120 divisions. That's U.S., right? So I'm wondering how many in Oregon there would be affected by this.
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, are you asking about how many schools?
Well, I guess. What
do you want?
How many programs?
Oregon State, Portland State.
Eastern, Southern, and Western.
So just those,
so just those seven in Oregon would be affected by this.
And then my follow-up would be, have any been successful in hiring
Southern, Western, and
minority head coaches?
Have they been successful?
Have any of them ever hired minority head coaches?
Actually, Portland State was the first, I believe, one of the first, if not the first in the country, to hire an African-American football coach back in the early 70s. And since then, head football coach, no. But there are assistant coaches on the current staffs.
And then, Madam Chair, my last question, and I think I asked you this in my office, but I would like you to say it on the record because I think this speaks to a lot of people's concerns. If we're not supposed to be hiring or interviewing or whatever in regard to race, it feels awkward to say, well, but in this, it just feels awkward to say, well, but in this case, we're going to base it on race. And then you had a good answer.
And Madam Chair and Representative Thatcher, my response to you then and today is that it's more of a problem that people are not being interviewed based on race, I think, than this bill, which requires at least one minority candidate. And that the statistics are reflective of the fact that 47% of the athletes are African American, more of them are minority, yet they're not getting the interviews. So race seems to be the factor.
Yeah, current Supreme Court decisions require colorblind hiring. You can't have a colorblind hiring if you don't have any minority candidates as part of the pool. And I think in order to honor the spirit of where affirmative action has gone now, I think this enhances where it is now. I mean, it doesn't require a hiring. It doesn't give special bonus for being a minority. All it does is say, make sure you have a proper pool in order to allow a colorblind selection process.
Thank you, Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick question. Why are you just limiting this to football?
Madam Chair, Representative Kopp.
Pretty even,
I just try to tackle one challenge at a time. the best idea would be for us to, touch volleyball, track, athletic directors specifically, which
absolutely.
Is a huge problem. That would be my best case scenario.
Next session we can expand.
Okay, thank you. Mm.
It's because he and I are both ex-football players. One real one and one fake one. He's the real one.
Representative Maurer?
Madam Chair, I've actually been involved in hiring a D1 coach at Northern Illinois University. We talked to Leslie Frazier, who's now with Minnesota. I was on that committee. And my question is, why are we not talking about basketball and volleyball and softball? To me, that's if we're gonna be the first in the state, we might as well be so far over the curve. Let's just do it. The reality is, most of these other programs, I mean, these are high profile positions. People are going to come out of the woodwork to apply for these positions. I just don't think it's going to be an issue. If it applies to football, it needs to apply to all these other sports. And the other, and another question I have is. Is in this case, are women a minority?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, again, I would love to see this cover all sports. I have no problem with that. And yes, the women are considered a minority.
Okay. I'll make a commitment, Representative Maurer. If we pass this out of the committee and out of the House floor, I'll prepare amendments on the Senate side to include all other sports and athletic directors.
Good.
See if we can move it back here in an improved version.
So, Representative Greenlick, I feel quite confident that we could get these amendments back very quickly and send it in this stronger form that we like rather than relying on the Senate to comply with our unwritten wishes.
We'll be happy to do that.
So with your permission, I think that we'll open the work session after we get through the rest of our testimony and hold that over to next week. And it sounds like the amendments we want to make is to expand it and also to add the word qualified.
Mm-hmm.
Is that acceptable to the
Great.
Sponsor?
Well, yeah. And in fact, we'll just change the head football coach to a head coach, and or athletic director, and put qualified in front of it. That'd be great.
Representative Van Orman?
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Well, I would like to say that this does shed a light on the hiring practices in the sports world. And I definitely feel it should include all sports. And I would like you to consider the fact that my son is a minority on a women's coaching team. So there's multiple,
you
know.
And he went all the way to the finals.
No, that was Louisville. I'm sorry to say it was Louisville. But I think it does point out that this is an exception to the rule that all the rest of us have been playing with, is which is equal opportunity and giving everybody a chance. So, you know, the hiring and firing in that whole system is suspect.
Representative, let's give your son credit. He went all the way to the finals, didn't he?
No, he did not. Louisville went. They got as far.
I'm going to give Representative. We've got more people to testify. We can catch up on that later. I'm going to give Representative Thatcher the last word. But before I forget, Representative Greenlee, can you drop that amendment request in this afternoon?
Yep.
Excellent. Thank you. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Just real fast, I'm just wondering if there's going to be any follow-up to see if this is resulting in just token interviews, or, you know, if this is just being abused, if it's really having the effect that we want.
Well, I would suggest we ask the university system on the whole question of affirmative action and their policy for. So I this fits in, as you noticed, to a bill that talks about moving these things forward, and I think that's a really legitimate thing to ask our universities. As a former department chair of a university, I can tell you it's a hard job in academia to try and honor this, but in athletics, it should be a piece of cake.
We have two committee members have two more things to say. We have someone waiting to testify that can answer many of these questions.
Yeah, I think.
So I want to make sure we get to him. Representative Roblin and then Representative Harker, and then we're moving on.
I think the NFL has shown that it works with, and they use penalties. I believe that we will know in the next few years whether it works. I mean, I think what the proof will be in what happens, and we'll all get to see that. And if we need to do more, we can do it then if it's not making any change. But I think I appreciate that.
Thank you. Representative Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think there are some people in this room scribbling frantically, and I suspect that they might be able to be put in charge of producing some reports out in the public media to let us know how this process is
going. It'll probably happen.
Third branch. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
I'm anxious to move. I need two of your committee members.
Oh, yes. Well, there's another committee that comes in, so we always have to end on time, and that's why.
Thank you for your time.
Everyone's on time for your committee. All right. Thank you both very much. Dalton Miller Jones and Carrie Hare. All right. Sorry.
Chair Gelsner, members of the House Education Committee. For the record, I am Dalton Miller Jones. I'm a professor of psychology and chair of Black Studies at Portland State University. And I have submitted a letter on behalf of the faculty in the Black Studies Department supporting this piece of legislation. I'm also here in my capacity as a director on the Board of Higher Education for the state of Oregon. And in that regard, I would point out that we, as a board, passed 7 diversity principles that we intend to hold our university presidents and chancellor accountable for actions like these, to see that we're reporting back, we know whether it's successful or not. And this legislation is completely supportive of that kind of move on our part. Why do we need this legislation when we already have affirmative action offices in our university? I believe the testimony by Sam Sachs a few minutes ago pointed out that there are too many ways to circumvent the requirements under various conditions of an emergency and so on. And that leads to, I think, the situation we have today, which has, for me, really two key consequences. First, there is the tacit, unstated so far in this testimony, psychological impact of this action. The Rooney rule came into existence because Rooney inadvertently stated in public that the reason there were so few
Major League Baseball managers who were black or minority was that they simply were not smart enough to do that. And if we don't recognize that that is at play in this situation, then I think we have failed to understand the importance of this legislation. The Supreme Court in 1954 made a decision about the impact of desegregation and the impact of segregation on the psychological well-being of students of color in this country. They did so on the basis of psychological evidence about the damaging impact to African Americans' self-concept for being segregated. This situation where over 40-something percent, 47% of the athletes being students of, being in this case students of color, and very few head coaches being that way, is an implicit tacit statement saying that you are not really smart enough. We deal with the consequences of that in our university at Portland State, in our department where many of the athletes come to seek refuge, solace, some attempt to understand why they're being treated the way they are by some assistant coaches, by some head coaches. It's an intolerable situation, and it doesn't get to the public nearly enough. So that's one reason. This goes on to impact students' performance in academic areas. A very prestigious black psychologist at Stanford University, Professor Claude Steele, and his graduate student, now a faculty person, Joshua Aronson, did research on a construct they call stereotype threat. The fact that we support these notions in symbolic ways in the country, that African Americans are not intelligent, comes back around and is there as a reason for why they do poorly on tests, because they are feeling like they're not capable of doing so. I won't try to give you the lecture that I give my students on this research, but I wish you would at least entertain the possibility that what I'm telling you is true.
And Dr. Miller-Jones, I'm going to have to ask you to summarize. We have 2 minutes left, and I'd like to give Carrie a chance to say a word or two.
I would like for Carrie to say more than a word or two. I will cut my comments at this point, and thank you for this opportunity. I would like to submit to the record a report on this situation. I'll tell you more than that. Thank you.
Wonderful.
Very
thank
for
you
that.
So much, and thanks for your patience.
Chair Gelston, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Herring. I am a board member of the Oregon Students of Color Coalition and a student at the University of Oregon. I'm currently writing my senior thesis in ethnic studies on the very issue of race in sports, specifically the modes of resistance practiced by black male athletes on the University of Oregon football team. While the shadow of the fame and glory may be attractive on the surface, I know of another side of the story based on a very different reality of our players, many of whom are African American men who not only struggle with the differences of moving to a homogenous community like Eugene, but are also seeking camaraderie from peers and mentorship from teachers. They're spending 40-plus hours a week devoted to their respective sport with coaches who not only serve as their instructors to victory, but also instructors to life. One of the players I spoke to about the possibility of this legislation passing gave an argument stating that if you have a team that is predominantly African American, of course the players are going to feel more comfortable based on cultural aspects alone. While this person is African American male, he made it clear that this was not solely an issue about race, but also performance, citing the fact that if you have players who have graduated from college who were in fact college athletes, if they don't make it to the league, they can come back and provide new innovative ideas as coaching on the coaching staff to the current players. An opportunity such as this would potentially allow for former players who have ended their collegiate careers to have shared experiences with their players. The issue of minority coaches has gained momentum on various levels. You heard earlier about the Black Colleges Coaches Association, as well as many multiple colleges have devoted a significant amount of study to addressing coaching and administrative disparities in intercollegiate athletics, including Northeastern University Center for Sport and Society and the Institute for Diversity and Ethics in Sports at Central Florida University. This institute in particular has generated substantive data that has revealed that 88 to 97% of the industry of college sports is run by Caucasian men. The demographic is simply not reflective of the student athletes who are participating in the sport, black or white, man or woman. There has been progress. People have already shown that underrepresented coaches can make this a possibility. Take, for example, Tony Dungy and Lovie Smith on the national stage, but a handful of examples are simply not enough. Consistent applications such as this legislation must be imposed. Funneling people and the inclusion of minority applicants into a pipeline is necessary to address the underrepresentation of minority coaches on a collegiate level for the state of Oregon.
Thank you very much. And unfortunately, we cannot take any questions or comments because our time together has expired. We are going to, Kevin, you're going to post this for next Friday?
Yes, we'll post this for next Friday.
As a work session, and that should give us time to get the amendment back and the new fiscal and revenue so that we can send it onto the floor. Thank you all very much. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3118, and the House Committee on Education is adjourned. Have a great weekend.
Weekend.